Welcome back. I hope you've enjoyed the series. As you know, we have 3 bonus episodes, and you may have already heard the first of them. In the remaining 2 bonus episodes, we'll do something very different. Each of them will feature a mini lecture by yours truly. I thought it was the most effective way to situate the lab, Brody, Johnson, and the others, in the technological and intellectual landscape of that era, but also to draw out their contemporary relevance. They are not just these eccentric, film-like characters. Some of you surely expected me to offer this intellectual background in the main episodes, yet I've decided against it. And the reason for that is very simple. I wanted the main story to hang together as drama with a logic of its own, and that logic works on the human and emotional level, not the intellectual one. It's all about relationships and traumas, aspirations and anxieties. I just felt that overloading you with details about our protagonists' views on technology or anything else would be too much to ask. But we do have the luxury of covering such things in the bonus episodes. Each of them has 5 mini chapters dealing with a particular facet of that episode's topic. In this episode, we'll deal with technology. And in the following one, we'll tackle playfulness. So yes, maybe we'll finally understand what that enigmatic name of the Brody Johnson venture, Ecology Tool and Toy, actually meant. Off we go. Chapter 1. Human Augmentation versus Human Enhancement. Technology, at least on its own, wasn't of great interest to either Warren Brody or Avery Johnson. Instead, they thought much more about what it is to be human, what it is to perceive, what it is to think, what it is to learn, what it is to grow. In other words, for them, technology could enable and facilitate, and occasionally disable and thwart, the process of human development. But it wasn't something that was worth theorizing on its own. Without humans in the picture, there was nothing obvious or interesting to be said about technology. To better understand their unique humanistic lens, we should clarify something important, namely the distinction between human augmentation, then the dominant paradigm for what computers can do for us, and human enhancement. The latter was a quirky, contrarian approach that Johnson and Brody rallied behind. At its core, human augmentation seeks to deploy computers to make the total hybrid system, one made of humans and machines, more productive. And by humans here, we mean Cold War cognitive workers in scientific labs, corporate offices, military institutions. So the big question at the time is this: how can we couple all these people with computers so as to allow them to focus on more creative, hard-to-automate tasks? If such human-computer symbiosis happens, then the system's total productivity will increase, with computers taking over the more mundane tasks. What kind of tasks, you might be wondering? Think of some of the early intended uses of neural networks. It was to analyze lots of aerial footage coming from spy planes and satellites so as to better understand what the Soviet enemy was doing. You see, in the early 1960s, so much data was coming in that the CIA had to turn to computers and basic forms of artificial intelligence. They did so, for example, to spare human operators from performing the mundane task of analyzing images, where no change had been detected. If these images can be found by machines, then humans can use their high-level cognitive functions on more meaningful images. Overall, the drawback to this kind of system is obvious. In focusing on productivity alone, it makes no distinction between humans and machines. So that if machines become better at what they do, one can get rid of humans eventually. After all, it's total productivity that counts. Thus, while there's all this romantic talk about man-machine symbiosis, it's more of a temporary marriage, where the unlucky partner would eventually be dropped. Now, Brody and Johnson arrive at their celebration of human enhancement through a very different path. Even though both of them have some contacts with the military-industrial complex, their program is very different. They want to use computer technologies to ensure that we become more receptive, more skillful, more creative. So no, they don't want symbiosis of any kind. They know that computers and people are different, and they only care about the latter here. But they do want to use computers to surround us with environments and technologies that will allow us to grow, to develop richer perception and understanding of the outside world. For both, many of these insights come from their work with the disabled, with Brody learning a lot from the blind, and Johnson spending some time working on prostheses and artificial limbs. From the perspective of human enhancement, productivity increases of the total system are completely irrelevant. This is so for a reason. What matters is not using technologies to get things done, but rather to see things differently. Here it's a matter of creativity, not productivity. But something else is going on here. The human augmentation paradigm, aimed at unburdening us from unnecessary, boring, and mundane thoughts and activities. Brody and Johnson doubt that such unburdening was actually feasible. But they also thought that it wasn't always desirable for even the most habitual of interactions have complex systems and processes behind them. And we should learn to see those systems and processes before destroying or automating the visible tip of the everyday iceberg. This, by the way, was the insight behind their whole agenda of responsiveness and of intelligent environments too. The key premise there was that one can find opportunities to grow even in the most conventional everyday artifacts and situations. All of them can be enrolled into this great mission of activating some amazing, life-transforming potentialities lying dormant within us. This is where I think Brody's background as psychoanalyst is not irrelevant. Ultimately, he thought that we can be awakened to the hidden, destructive, automated patterns in our lives. And objects and environments can do it in much the same way that good psychoanalysts do. Aren't they the ones to understand that greater productivity is pointless if it makes us unhappy? Or that there's no point in being the richest or most productive person at the cemetery? That what truly matters is learning, being open to the world, knowing how to deal with novelty and complexity, how to experience reality in richer ways that go beyond our already mastered patterns. So it's probably not surprising that the paradigm of human enhancement, rather than that of human augmentation, proved more appealing to them. And to be honest, it still sounds more appealing today, at least to me. Chapter 2. Information. Another unique feature of how Brody and Johnson thought about technology has to do with their rather unconventional views on information. For example, Brody's early psychiatric work contains one fascinating idea. He argued that environments and systems that are saturated with information are not necessarily rich in responsiveness or opportunities for learning. Information, he argued, can also substitute for it, because it gets digested and metabolized based on outdated, irrelevant mental frameworks. So more information can give us a false sense of epistemological security, misleading us into thinking that we are learning, while in fact we are just trafficking in confirmation bias. As a result, in truly learning, growth-oriented families, information wasn't king. But responsiveness was. In other words, there'll be plenty of situations in such families where the right move, by the parent for example, is to pursue the strategy of non-communication. What does it mean? Well, sometimes it's better to let the kids alone. It's better to give them space to grow than to continue asking questions or trying to decipher what it all means. Brody even came up with these twin notions of being in contact and being out of contact. Paradoxically, being in contact can sometimes mean engaging in deliberate non-communication. On the other hand, being out of contact, not a good thing, can involve all sorts of spurious information flows. Information flows to fill in the gaps of our accounts of reality and each other. Thus, for Brody, responsiveness wasn't about matching every single aspect of a social situation bit by bit. Rather, it was about understanding what was appropriate in a given context. That's why they spoke so much about courtesy. It was about figuring out the right thing from context. Implied in what I've just told you about Brody's view of information is another intriguing idea. Namely, that the meaning of a given piece of information is not contained in the media that transmit it. Rather, it emerges as we actively interpret it in our heads and bodies. And there are all sorts of extra factors that shape how we do this. Narcissists, to take Brody's favorite example, twist and turn such information. They do so in order not to hurt their own ego, not to disturb their existing view of the world. In other words, they have all these mental categories that overimpose erroneous meanings and interpretations on information. So this is this rather negative view on what such interpretation is. But in Avery Johnson, we also find a more uplifting position, which basically says that what is noise for some of us is profoundly meaningful to others. How so? Well, it's easy. Some of us speak foreign languages, or have gone to art school, or know how to play a musical instrument. All those skills allow us to find extra layers of meaning in streams of information that others cannot possibly decipher. Johnson, I must add, makes all these arguments using evidence from his research in neurophysiology. He thinks it's not just about how we perceive art or use language. That's pretty much how we perceive everything around us. So the corollary of this position is that people who grow up in different cultures and socioeconomic settings are probably primed to perceive reality differently. Of course, to truly get there, they need to practice and cultivate their dispositions. They need to actively participate in the world. That's how Johnson would put it. What he wants then is to live in a world where each of us can develop our interests to the fullest, so that more and more things can suddenly start mattering to us. Yes, you've heard that right. Mattering. He liked that word. And computers, instead of reducing information to a point where it's even harder to decipher it, can actually help in that process. Armed with such insights, one can build an entire political theory, even if Brody and Johnson didn't go that far. This theory would advocate that we should do what we can to let people cultivate their talents, and that we should make our environments and institutions amenable to the pursuit of that mission. So once again, for them, the point is not to just give us access to all the books, songs, or videos in the universe. We already have lots of that via Spotify or streamers like Netflix. No, the point is to allow people to discover new skills and cultivate new tastes, and to do it in such a way that entire new cultural niches and subcultures would emerge. It's about the quality and diversity of information, not its quantity. And algorithmic solutions will not do. We can't delegate the process of mattering to computers. They can help us, sure, but we cannot have them care about art or the world in general on our behalf. We cannot outsource the very thing that makes us human. Chapter 3: Interfaces and Computers. Now, as I've already told you, for Brody and Johnson, there's no meaning or mattering without accounting for context. Once you fully grasp this notion, you are much closer to understanding their immense frustrations. Frustrations with the 1960s world of computers and interfaces. Brody and Johnson knew that when we communicate, there are many invisible structures underneath our dialogue. Plus, there are numerous invisible processes happening in the background. And of course, we deploy all kinds of deciphering mechanisms to get at the meaning of what we've just heard. It's all complex, non-linear, interwoven. As frequent participants to such dialogues, we are always looking for cues. Any cues. Cues that can help us understand the context of the interaction. One example often used by Johnson was the ambiguity of a command such as "get undressed," depending on whether it's uttered in the bedroom, the doctor's office, or the dark alley, its meaning is very different. So to hear it is not enough to understand it. One needs to know the context in which it is said. When we're talking to a human, we can always probe that context by asking direct and indirect questions. But how do we do that with computers? And think of big, clunky computers of the 1960s. And computers too, they have no ways to explore us. Let alone understand what we mean when we issue commands like "get undressed." So a lot of context gets lost due to the flaws in our interfaces. And Brody and Johnson were really angry about that. That's why they wanted to build interfaces that would be much more responsive and interactive. This was a way of solving that context problem. In an article from the late 1960s, Avery Johnson writes that computers are often imagined as secretaries. This, by the way, is very much in line with the human augmentation paradigm. But, argues Johnson, these secretaries seem to be mute. They never ask follow-up questions because they cannot, all due to the limitations of the interfaces. But that's not how real secretaries work, nor is it how craftsmen or artisans work. All of them probe us to elaborate what we truly want and need. And our computer's interfaces, he argued, should ideally be like this too. Another related feature that Brody and Johnson wanted in computer interfaces had to do with their ambition of helping us become more skillful and perceptive. Think of good teachers who constantly check our progress as we learn something. The best of them would surely make us aware of dimensions and indicators that we never noticed before, so as to accelerate our mastery. Maybe our piano teacher tells us something about the importance of posture. And now that we pay attention to it, we perform better as a result. Brody and Johnson thought that our interfaces can output such context-sensitive feedback too. Such feedback was key to what Johnson called reflexive participation in society. In other words, to be truly reflexive, we must constantly expand our horizons and learn about the existence of dimensions and dynamics that were invisible to us before. This, after all, is how true mastery is achieved. And this, by the way, what a good psychoanalyst does too. They make us aware of dimensions and indicators that have until then escaped us. So once again, the hope was to enroll computers and technologies in providing feedback about hidden structures and processes that are unfolding all around us. Feedback that would allow us to be more masterful in the conduit of our social life. Amazing, isn't it? That's the kind of interface critique we don't hear much about these days, do we? Chapter 4: Against Machinic Civilization. So you may have guessed by now that Johnson and Brody were not thrilled with the kind of computers that were being developed at the time. Nor were they enthusiastic about the kind of everyday objects that were being manufactured by the consumerist capitalism of the 1960s. Cheap and standardized, these products were good for satisfying our basic needs. But they didn't help us cultivate new and sophisticated desires, beyond consumption itself, that is. And this distinction between needs and desires, or between hunger and appetite, was extremely important to Brody and Johnson. You might remember that I say as much in the main podcast. So yes, they thought that we humans have this elevated cultural dimension to us. We can transcend our needs. We can make so many things, things that are completely irrelevant to our survival, suddenly matter to us. It's by cultivating appetites and learning new skills that what used to be noise can re-emerge as information, to acquire meaning, to start mattering. And it's precisely at that level that they critiqued all these cheaply mass-produced standardized goods. Sure, they were extremely good at satisfying our needs, but they did little to cultivate our appetites. And these industrial products were imprisoned in the old paradigms, those of the mechanism and of the clock. There was too much regularity and prediction. There was no evolution nor becoming anywhere in sight. It was all the same. Brody and Johnson wanted something different. They wanted devices and gadgets and computers that were inspired by the principles of life, by the ideal of constant growth and constant learning. They were hoping these other devices would be more responsive to the outside world, and that such responsiveness, in turn, would result in internal transformation of their system. That's how living beings operate anyway. Thus, there was nothing technophobic in their critique. They wanted life like computers and life like interactivity. In retrospect, it's obvious that their views were shaped by what we might call environmental determinism. The idea that our computers, environments, even buildings affect our subjectivities and life pathways and trajectories. That's why it was so important for them to think carefully about how we live, how we structure our classrooms and houses, how we construct what Brody eventually comes to call intelligent environments. Because it's only by surrounding ourselves with lifelike technologies that we would be reminded that the world around us is artificial, plastic, revisable. Our world, in other words, is something that can be changed, and so is our life. We can always do things differently. We can always question things we take for granted. And technologies can help us with some of that questioning. Instead of helping us to adapt to the increasingly complex world, they can help us understand how to modify it, or at least how to modify our adaptation to it. So the kinds of technologies and environments advocated by Brody and Johnson become tools of rebellion. Rebellion against the one-dimensional static programming. Programming that industrial civilization was imposing on the world. Instead, they wanted computers to amplify deviance and variety, diversity and variation. Again, I find this vision extremely appealing. Of course, they formulated these insights in the late 1960s. Sadly, they used too many half-baked hippie ideas for this to become something tangible, something political. Nor did they notice how their own class standing shaped their views. But all of these are critiques that can be addressed. Their analytical mistakes can be avoided. This focus on appetites, on diversity, on desires, on variety, this all sounds most promising. Especially to those of us who are interested in figuring out what a post-neoliberal, post-market future might look like. But let us not get too distracted. This perhaps is a story for another podcast. Chapter 5. Intelligence. The key aspect of intelligence, according to Brody and Johnson, has nothing to do with technology, but rather with ecology. Thus, intelligence for them is unthinkable without an external environment and the human presence somewhere in it. To repeat, the idea that a machine could be intelligent while completely disconnected from the outside world or its human user is nonsense. This ecological grounding presents intelligence as something attuned to contextual variation. Let me explain what this all means. In the late 1960s, Avery Johnson co-authored a fascinating paper. It's a most intriguing variation on Turing test, spelling out criteria to judge machine intelligence. That paper concludes that intelligence is nothing but the assimilation of human culture. Therefore, building true intelligence in computers would require giving them access to all this assimilated culture. And not just in terms of facts, but in terms of understanding what these facts mean. One example they give in the paper is about the ability to understand jokes. And jokes, they are extremely sensitive to context. Many of them work by re-embedding behaviors and artifacts in novel contexts that we were not expecting. It doesn't help that contexts, they do change and evolve, all the time. A computer trained on data from a month ago might not understand jokes from tonight's comedy show. You can probably guess why. It lacks the updated cultural context. Humans, in contrast, often grasp the meaning of jokes even without knowing all the facts. We can do it because we know how to tap into universal archetypes of human experience. So yes, we can beat machines in understanding jokes, even if we haven't followed the news. Isn't such ability a true hallmark of intelligence? Brody and Johnson very much thought so. For them, intelligence isn't about following rules or procedures or even solving problems. No, intelligence is about drawing on our assimilated culture to decipher contexts and act with courtesy. So, naturally, they weren't all that thrilled by the prospect of building artificial intelligence. For it to work as intended, it would need to stop being artificial and tap into the whole of human culture. But think about it. How can computers possibly do that? So Brody and Johnson looked elsewhere. Instead, they argued intelligent systems should enhance human capacities. So we are back to the human enhancement agenda. Thus, the goal of Brody's intelligent environments is to enable more intelligent behaviors in their users, maximizing and enhancing human intelligence. Once again, it's not about building intelligent environments for the sake of having intelligent technologies. The latter should exist to help enhance the intelligence of humans. These ideas of Brody and Johnson are appealing, and for a very good reason. They highlight that billions of people already possess cognitive, sensory, and aesthetic capacities that far surpass those of computers, including AI systems like ChatGPT. Thus, investing in enhancing human intelligence might be a wiser move than trying to replicate it in computers. I can go on and on and on. I do hope that the podcast and these bonus episodes have convinced you of the richness of Brody and Johnson's theoretical frameworks. At the very least, their insights foreshadow many of today's discussions in embodied and distributed cognition. And there's so much else to consider here. If you're intrigued, you're in luck. We do have a website for the podcast where you'll find key works by Avery Johnson and Warren Brody. Do check it out. In the final bonus episode, we'll tackle the question of play and playfulness. And we might even understand why toys became the ultimate solution to the problems that Brody and Johnson identified. For now, I'd just like to thank you for paying attention. Until next time.